Wesley watched skeptically as Rosenberg unlocked her safe house door.
I'm not loving this idea, Teresa.
You mean about having two men you don't know hanging around with me?
Seems that since we met this guy, you've come under enemy fire twice. And we only met them a couple hours ago.
Once an hour? That's not so bad for him.
Those beautiful green eyes sparkled with wit and allure, making Wesley look away, inwardly wincing as he felt himself being dragged in by her beauty.
Robert.
I'm sorry. I'm not looking forward to seeing you get hurt.
Who says I'm going to get hurt?
A bunch of really angry goombas we kicked out of power who are still packing enough rifles to shoot up half the country. That's who.
I've had people out to get me before. I'll leave.
I'm serious, Teresa.
Call me Tara.
Tara. Sorry.
I'm serious too, Robert.
Wesley reflexively bared his teeth, then calmed himself.
You say you can trust him. So tell me, is Stone his real name?
I can't confirm or deny that for you. It's not my place. I can tell you, though, even though we worked together only once, I trust him with every ounce of my being.
I see.
Wesley hung his head. Garen touched his chin lightly, lifting his eyes to meet hers.
I understand you're worried about me, and I'm worried about you too. And I would worry about Stone, but he can take care of himself, and he's taken care of me in the past.
He charges in wild-ass.
He can be as stealthy or as audacious as circumstances warrant, and he won't let me down. Robert, I know you don't like it, but I also don't want you involved in our investigation. Stone and I are going after, I think, the same people. And there's going to be a lot of gunplay.
Then have a soldier at your back, at least.
Captain Blake wants you back alive, and I don't want to see you hurt.
Sorry. He said come back if possible. That was my priority. I'm also supposed to keep an eye on you and Colonel Stone. Don't try to leave me behind.
I don't see the harm in you tagging along.
Wesley looked up to see Colonel Stone seemingly appear out of nowhere. He was shaken for a moment.
Thank you, Colonel, sir.
Don't call me sir. I work for a living.
Bolin offered his hand. Some of the distrust and jealousy that Wesley was hanging on to evaporated in the face of the gesture. The Green Beret took the stranger's hand.
Sorry for being so much trouble.
You're not any trouble. Just please don't interfere with me getting fresh weapons.
I wasn't going to have Tara go into harm's way without someone adequately equipped on her side.
Good. Captain Blake won't have a problem with that.
Wesley looked around.
Captain who? Problem with what? Okay, soldiers. I'll meet you two back here.
Wesley walked off as Tara Garen turned the doorknob to her safe house.
I'll need a medical kit to take care of things.
Garen threw her arms around his shoulders and squeezed tight.
I missed you, big guy.
She broke off the hug and smiled at him.
I'm sorry. It's just good to see a friendly face.
I can tell. And I can sympathize.
Bolin took off his battle harness. Garen crooked an eyebrow at the payload, then noticed he was peeling out of his black suit's top. She glanced out the window and saw the graying of the dawn.
Where's the rest of your stuff? We can probably swing by and pick it up sometime tomorrow. Make that today.
And how do you know I have more stuff?
You gave up your guns too easily. Plus, I know you're prone to having more than just a shirt on your back.
We had spare ammo and grenades in a car not far from where we met up. Trouble is, I didn't bring spare firearms. I had planned to replenish my stocks from what we got from the enemy.
When she turned, she saw him stripped down to the waist, fresh bruises and the gunshot wound on his arm standing out against the tracks of toned muscle, bronzed skin, and crisscross of scar tissue that made up his torso. The crosshatch of whitened smooth lines of healed skin were a roadmap of a life lived in danger. The bloody smear dripping along one bicep came from a slash that would be yet another streak. She pulled her kit box from the top shelf.
I've got some painkillers for the stitching.
I'd prefer to do without.
Not even local anesthetic?
Do you have that?
She rooted through the kit box for a moment.
Not really.
Then why offer what you don't have?
I'm trying to make you feel more comfortable. You've got a gunshot wound, and you're just sitting there all expressionless and expect me to dig a needle into your skin and sew your arm shut.
I deal with the pain.
Garen shrugged and began closing the slash.
It doesn't hurt?
I'm not that numb. I just don't let it get to me. If I'm taking painkillers, I can't tell when I'm pushing my injuries too hard. I also don't like having my head all cloudy.
Eventually, Garen pulled the last suture shut, 6 in all. She wrapped his arm in paper tape to keep the stitches from shifting under the skin. Bolin moved his arm, checking his range of motion. He was satisfied with it. Their priorities were being taken in order. After rest and recuperation, Bolin and his allies were sufficiently recovered by afternoon from the hectic activities of the previous night. Medical care and some sleep had the executioner feeling at least back in battle condition. Bolin had filled his empty stomach with a half loaf of bread and some dried beef jerky. A handful of multivitamins would handle the rest of his nutritional needs. It wasn't perfect, but Bolin had done what he could with what he had. Food was fuel, and no matter what he laid his hands on, when he had the opportunity, he topped himself off.
Next order of business. We're gonna need some guns.
I think that's directed toward me.
Blake didn't disarm you. That means he eventually got tired of trying to.
Golly, Batman, is there anything you don't know?
I'd prefer you gear up from Terra's stash too, Wesley.
Well, I'm not gonna risk leaving behind any clues that Green Berets are on a search-and-destroy mission. Not when I'm supposed to be keeping out of the fighting. I'll gladly trade in for someone else's gear.
Good. Laith, do you have any problem with working with the Mossad?
Laith gave Garen a glance, his face screwed in an indecipherable expression. Garen squirmed uncomfortably.
You don't have a problem working together.
The Khans have been the Mossad local contacts for operations against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan for a long time, Colonel. My family isn't too interested in a bunch of foreigners thinking they can murder, rape, or otherwise bully people in our homeland.
They give us intel, safe houses, and storage points for us to make excursions into Pakistan. The Kashmir might be a reason for a nuclear war between Pakistan and India, but those nukes could also quite easily be used in support of a terrorist operation against Israel.
I won't tell.
Bolin looked to Wesley, who was staring off into space. The young captain jerked back to attention as he realized the others were looking at him.
What?
I don't think he heard anything that would result in his brakes failing on a mountain road in his future. I'm not naive enough to think that we haven't been watched. It's just that the Pakistanis shouldn't ever find out about anything.
I'm not telling Pakistan jack shit about anything but how to sit and spin.
Good. We'll gear up and start hunting again come sunset. Any good leads?
Well, I'm pretty sure they'd have ditched the car by now. But there was a gold Peugeot that got shot up during the ambush back at HQ. The driver seemed to be paying close attention to you three. Most likely you, Terra.
We saw him take off. He didn't seem too friendly with the Taliban guys.
He was an Arab, but who and why?
Garen cast her eyes to the floor, avoiding contact with anyone.
You think he's Palestinian?
She stayed motionless, not even a flinch. But even the absence of a reaction is a reaction. She'd steeled herself against a direct question.
Terra, you never explained your mission.
She told us she was investigating the murder of an Israeli national who was in the relief group that got hit.
It's a good story, Wesley, but they wouldn't have sent her. They'd have sent a small army, and they'd be tearing up the countryside with relative impunity.
What are you implying, Stryker?
You work by yourself. You're pretty much a sheet in the wind. Sure, you're a full-fledged agent, but you get thrown into situations where Tel Aviv wouldn't want someone scrutinizing its actions. You'd either have to be a crusader with an agenda or a pariah to be stuck on solo missions. You're one or the other to get the jobs you get.
Which one are you?
She tried to look upset, but her anger was as much reflecting inward as toward the executioner. Bolin smiled at Garen. The fireball wasn't going to wither with just a gentle breeze.
I'm a man doing my duty.
A little of both, then.
And your job?
Not going to ask me why they think they can leave me running around on my own? Why they think I'm expendable?
It's not our concern now. The Mossad is worried about the killings of a UN relief worker, but I don't think they're as interested in the murder of one of their nationals as they are in who caused the murder.
Her eyes flashed with emerald anger again. Bolin had her, and he frowned. He was not enjoying peeling away her cover story, leaving her exposed and vulnerable. She stared at him, the anger melting away as she noticed his own growing guilt.
Terra, we need to know what we're up against, and you're keeping your mouth shut.
They call themselves Abraham's Dagger. At least, that's what they claimed once we found out who they were.
What did they call themselves before they got exposed?
Mossad agents and Israeli soldiers. It was an organization that was on both sides of government sanction in the administration. Private citizens and officers, troops and politicians from all walks of life, all pushing the government toward harsher and harsher measures against the Palestinian problem.
And you got caught in the middle of this.
It's a job. Just a job. Most of the people I work with don't like the fact that collateral damage happens when we go up against scumbags like Hamas or hardcore Palestinian thugs. Using an F-16 to blow up an apartment building and a bunch of sleeping children just to get one guy isn't the way we take care of business. We're pros. We get the job done. We take care of the guilty, and we leave the innocent unhurt.
Abraham's dagger would rather go the easy route.
You know vigilantes.
Bolin felt that shot as sure as if she intended it for his gut. The executioner had long walked the line between being a man on a mission and being a cold-blooded murderer. He chose his battles, doing so when he felt the law wouldn't take a hand or was powerless to act. Bolin limited himself in his war plans, however. He would never accept civilian losses. He risked his life to save people from the spillover of his conflicts. When he struck, he was always dead certain of his prey's guilt. Most of the time, if there was any doubt, he tried to cut and run, preferring to continue the battle on his own terms later on. There had been a few exceptions, and those few instances left scars seared across his soul far worse than the streaks of whitened flesh on his skin. It would have been easier, even safer, to wage his war like the tactics of Abraham's dagger Terra was describing. But he would never give in to that type of battle.
I know vigilantes.
They've gone too far. For the longest time, they almost stepped across the line. People were willing to ignore them when they made their own punitive strikes against terrorists and their families. The dead child of a terrorist was at least someone who wouldn't grow up to be a terrorist.
Fucked up way to fight a war.
Then, the dagger came down on a refugee camp. Maybe it was soldiers on active duty, maybe it wasn't. They went through and slaughtered 100 men, women, and children, and wounded almost 1,000 more. A few UN workers spotted them, but they were transferred out as fast as possible. The UN denied that their people saw anything, but Abraham's dagger didn't buy it. People started dying. 2 automobile accidents. 1 poor guy drowned in his bathtub after someone piled 3 cinder blocks on his chest.
And now they come to Afghanistan?
Sophia de la Roque was a witness to the massacre that happened in a refugee camp called Shafiq. When she came over here, it was an effort to make her unreachable. Trouble is, Mossad knows. Abraham's dagger knows. So guess which red-headed stepchild gets sent to take these guys on.
Witnesses reported there were Afghan soldiers. Former Taliban enforcers. Sorry.
Verbal shorthand. Those dogs aren't worthy to be described by my country's name, but then my country was sloth-like in throwing off their yoke. Enough of that. The ex-Taliban types can be explained easily. They're hard up for money. They came here hired by rich and fanatical Saudi and Yemeni citizens, sons of princes and oil magnates, looking to make the perfect Islamic state. Now, with the bosses dead or in hiding, they're hiring themselves out to whoever wants to give them some cash. So we have fanatics who got bit by the pragmatism bug. No great causes they can die for, so they might as well get paid to kill for something.
Terrorists have been that way across history. They start with a devotion to a cause, but if they don't die off or end up in jail, they learn there's a profit to be made. There might be old believers still out there, still true blue to their ideology, but they're either in organizations too poor to engage in real operations, or they're fangless in what actions they do take.
This is all well and good, but we started talking about someone in a car watching you, Terra.
If he was watching me and took off when things got nasty, then that means we have Palestinians on the scene too. And while we really can't call them friends, they aren't going to be interested in attacking me because I'm doing the footwork in locating the people they really want to hit.
Abraham's dagger. It's going to be a crossfire. The dagger's going to be hunting the UN workers currently in country. And we have Palestinians racing with us to hunt down the dagger members. Throw in the United States Special Forces watching to see that everyone behaves, and we'll be having a 4-way dance.
Well, I can help smooth things over with Blake, if possible. Maybe we can form a temporary truce with the Palestinians. Maybe.
I'd prefer that, Wesley. Trouble is, if we come to their doorstep, there's no guarantee that they won't try kicking us off.
And they'd do the kicking to the tune of an AK.
Bingo. So we're going to have to make a decision on how we're going to deal with them.
I'm all for extra muscle on our side for once. If we go hunting for the Palestinian team, we'll probably force a shootout. In the field, we might be able to form a truce.
The enemy of my enemy?
I just want you to make sure you're all certain who your targets are. We can avoid an extra force gunning for us if we act smart. If not, stay close to cover and keep in communication with the rest of us. We'll pull you out. Am I clear?
The other three nodded in unison.
Crystal clear.
Bolin didn't feel a wave of sweeping inspiration from his army, but at least they seemed to have their heads all together. They had a common goal, and at least gave lip service to working together.
Now, let's get some guns.
The stash was hidden in the remains of an old Soviet occupation-era garage. While the shell of the building had been chewed away by battle and erosion, the inside was in good enough condition that the stairwell to the basement was undamaged. The center of the basement was taken up by the smashed remains of a hydraulic lift. The only sign that the garage was anything but ruins was a door that was solid. It was weathered, but the locks were stainless steel, the hinges were new and shielded behind more steel, and the whole thing was painted slapdash with splotches of black and brown to simulate rust and fire damage. Inside, hidden behind empty cardboard boxes, should have been the crates of equipment. However, they had already been opened.
Abraham's dagger was here.
They would know the best spots to go shopping. There are other arsenals we can use.
We'd be wasting time running across Afghanistan. We'll take what we need here.
Okay, Stone.
Boland looked over the choices he had. He was pleased to note that there were radios with earphones and throat mics. That would make a lot of difference in a combat situation. Communication was vital, and when he worked with others, he was always glad to have the best possible electronics on hand. He took 8, 4 spares in case the radios got damaged. The executioner was pleased to come across a cache of 44 Magnum Desert Eagles. Though the guns were Israeli designed, the stockpile of Magnum autoloaders were actually the Minnesota-built Magnum research designs. Boland loaded a pair into his war bag along with 6 50-round boxes of 240-grain hollow-point bullets.
Check out the micro-Uzis.
You don't have any stores of Uzi magazines here.
Oh, these are the Mark IIs. They take regular and extended Glock pistol magazines. The most popular 9mm pistol in the world.
Boland picked up the Uzi pistol. He checked to see how it handled single-handedly. He then found a box of shoulder harnesses for the Uzi pistols.
Good. We'll take 8 and all the Glock mags and 9mm ammo we can carry.
The home office isn't going to appreciate all their inventory walking off in someone else's war bags.
Then the home office should keep its so-called patriots from slaughtering refugees and relief workers. Sorry, Tara.
You don't have to get on my case. I'm chasing those bastards, same as you are. They stepped over a line we didn't want them to either.
So how come they're still on the loose?
8 of them are in jail. Another 3 are dead, resisting arrest. But they were handled on Israeli soil, and they were handled quietly.
Sorry, I didn't know.
That was the point of handling it on our soil. That's the point of sending me by myself to take these animals down on my own. We don't want it advertised that our people are overreacting and are behind murdering children for the sake of bloodthirsty revenge.
I'm not going to leak anything. As you hinted before, I'm as much a loose cannon as you are. I do my duty, and that's protecting the innocent and punishing the guilty.
Garen's face softened, and Boland could see an apology already forming. He shook his head and put a finger to his lips.
Let's chalk the tension up to incomplete intel. I don't allow myself to get upset, usually.
That warrior monk bullshit only goes so far. You are just a man, remember? Unless you really are bulletproof.
Nope. I've just been smart enough to avoid bad luck, and lucky enough when I was caught flat-footed, and quick enough to handle things before I even had to recognize I was in trouble.
So it's not all in the reflexes.
Boland turned away and tried on the Uzi harness.
What are you trying to dance away from?
I just don't think that going into the metaphysics of my survival is important. I'd rather concentrate on what I have to do and how to do it well.
Just keep putting one boot in front of the other and don't think about how far the walk is.
It's one way to put it. I'm glad I have someone I know and is a proved quantity on my side. It makes things easier.
Even if you do worry about me.
Boland looked down at her, shook his head, and stepped away, slipping a jacket over the Uzi harness. He didn't allow himself a glance back at her.
We've got work to do, Tara.
Steiner was sitting still inside the tent as Rodin paced back and forth. He seemed to be the center of a drain of nervous energy. Each time Rodin passed him, it was harder and harder for the Abraham's Dagger Commando to keep up his frustration.
Damnation.
Relax.
How do you do that?
Steiner looked up and managed a smile that didn't reach his sad eyes. Nothing ever reached those haunted orbs.
Clean living, I guess.
We got one target, but you didn't give us much of a chance to interrogate her about the others, did you?
She was halfway out the window and ready to bolt. I had to stop her.
So you killed her?
We have Soze and the others tracking the other women down.
Rodin shook his head. The tent opened, and Rodin spun, half expecting to see one of their Taliban allies poking his head through. Instead, it was Soze himself.
Speak of the devil, and he shall come.
Soze's swarthy, tanned face twisted into a sneer at the calm assassin. Then he turned back to Rodin.
We tried to take care of the Garen woman.
She's still alive. Bad enough the Mossad is turning us into criminals for doing what they're too puny to do. Now they're sending a woman after us.
Not a woman. Garen.
Rodin paced to one corner of the tent and grabbed a cigarette.
Bad enough it's a woman, but the granddaughter of a fucking Nazi.
Who better to hunt Jews than a Nazi? Naughty Jews chased after by a squeaky, clean little goose-stepping dyke.
I wouldn't underestimate her. What happened?
We had our friends watching the American base camp, watching for her return. When she arrived, she had two newcomers with her. Our Taliban rejects described them as one local and one American. One recognized the local as one of the Khan brothers.
The other? Tall American? Black hair?
Yes.
Steiner's jaw set. His normally impassive face suddenly went as hard as stone. Even the eyes narrowed, as if focusing his incredible mental power into a laser beam.
What's wrong?
Let me guess, Sose. They opened up on the American stranger, and he was instrumental in breaking the ambush. You suffered nearly complete losses, too.
How do you know
that? I know the pattern.
The good news is one of our men kept undercover. He didn't join in the fight and watched as the three of them and an American Green Beret were sent off. The American didn't have a weapon anymore.
Rodin, we should put a team on the weapons cache.
Why?
A good soldier never passes up a chance to rearm, and Garen knows about the cache. The American will be looking for quality gear, and that's what we have. Chances are they'll also be looking for any clues we left behind.
We didn't leave any traces behind.
Everyone leaves clues behind. Just by the fact that we took stuff from a Mossad forward cache.
Rodin slapped his forehead and kicked the tent post. Steiner raised one big calloused hand and pressed it to his partner's chest.
Please don't do that again.
Why?
I don't want the tent falling on me. I'll lead the team against Garen and the American.
I can't risk that.
You can't risk Garen's new ally causing us trouble. Surely you've heard the stories.
Rumors. Fantasies.
About who?
Some people call him Al-Askari. Others just call him the soldier. He's responsible for destroying countless terrorist groups.
So then he'd be on our side?
We're operating as a terrorist group. There's not a shred of proof that he exists.
Except dead terrorists from pole to pole, Rodin. Terrorists who end up dead for no other reason than their actions brought down the vengeance of the soldier.
Oh, no. You believe this crap too, Soze?
Better safe than sorry. We'll stage an ambush at the cache.
Even if it isn't the super soldier, he's still someone who's going to be another threat at our backs, sir.
All right. Saddle up and give them a warm welcome.
Yes, Soze. A very warm welcome.
Like a snake coiled in the shadows to avoid being addled by the sunlight, Greb Steiner nestled behind the scope of his Zastava M76, an 8mm Mauser round under the hammer, ready to spit across the 400 yards between him and the cache. Rodin wanted him on hand for the hit against Terra Garen and her mysterious allies, but he didn't want the sad-eyed assassin anywhere near the action. Beside him, manning an RPK machine gun, was Soze. Both were relegated to watching and coordinating the action from afar, keeping under cover and out of sight. Throat microphones and earpieces conveyed messages between the Israelis and their Taliban dupes. Steiner had less respect for the men closing in on the four people at the cache than he held for the bacteria that helped him digest food in his lower intestine. The militiamen hadn't questioned why six strangers came to their lands and spoke perfect Arabic, even if it was in an Egyptian dialect. They merely accepted the money, the guns, the support, and leadership of trained warriors to continue their jihad against the invading Westerners who sought to wipe away the decades of a perfect Islamic paradise. Their idealism had been flushed away in the hard rain of American rage post 9/11, their government destroyed, their organization disrupted by a cleansing storm. Now they were bullying who they could in order to have money and food and a roof over their heads. They were no longer vampires who sucked the blood of a people exhausted from the Soviet invasion and frightened of an organized, fanatical intrusion. They were ticks, fleas, parasites who burrowed into the skin and scurried away from scratching fingers. But they made good cannon fodder. Steiner and his team were fluent in Arab dialects and chose Egyptian because that was who they were tanned to resemble. Back when they still bore the stamp of legitimacy in the Israeli government, they were undercover agents, trained to sound and look like native Palestinians, Syrians, Lebanese, anyone who could be an enemy. The Taliban thought the weapons cache was an Egyptian holdout, a safeguard against possible trouble from nearby Iran or Pakistan. A safe enough lie that was close to the truth. Only the national ownership was off, and that was only by one geographic step to the left. The ex-militiamen didn't care. Cash was coming to them. Their hands were wrapped around guns. They instilled terror. And riding along in their shadow, silent and invisible, were the warriors of Abraham's dagger, cutting away any who would betray the true identities of those who brought justice to the murdered children of Israel by murdering the children of their enemies. Steiner felt a cold calm, as always. Avoiding the cooking sun in the shadows, his heart was still and easy, hands steady as stone, eyes locked like lasers on his enemies as they left two outside to guard them and give warning. Steiner was not afraid of getting in close, of going nose to nose in combat with his enemies, no matter how strong, how armored, how tough they were. But his orders were clear. He was to observe only. The sniper rifle was only a precaution in case they came under fire from below, or if the enemy managed to capture one of their Taliban cohorts alive. An 8mm round between the shoulder blades would slice off any attempts at interrogation. Steiner figured the logic. If he and Soze got into close combat and failed, even their corpses would provide volumes of information to a determined and skilled specialist. Diet and dust residue alone would be flaming arrows pointing back across the countryside to Rodin and the others. Steiner was willing to die to fight off the barbarian hordes laying siege to his nation, but he wasn't so stupid as to die and leave himself as decomposing evidence to betray his brothers. If this ambush failed, there were other ways to ensure that Garin and her friends would end up going to their just reward. Throwing themselves after a failed assault would be pointless. Soze mopped his brow, fist clenched around the pistol grip of the RPK.
We should just hose down those two and let our pals drop grenades down the stairwell.
That might work.
Steiner settled the crosshairs of his rifle on the face of a tall young American with a goatee, standing near a smaller native-looking man. Both were dressed in jumpsuits and battle vests. The American looked in his mid-20s, and he most definitely wasn't the stranger who set off the alarm bells in his head the night before. If anything, he recognized the youngster as one of the so-called faceless soldiers who had been assigned to the town. He imagined the young man's face exploding as 195 grains of supersonic lead punched through bone and brain matter, smashing it apart like a rotted melon. However, Steiner kept his finger off the trigger. He wanted all four out in the open, burdened with packages, flat-footed and off guard.
Tighten up on that right flank.
The militiamen were not soldiers. They weren't used to dealing with enemies unless they outgunned and outnumbered them. Against the concentrated force of the American military, they evaporated like gasoline spilled on a street. From hiding and ambush, using the tactics of craven cowards, they were hot shit using car bombs and bullets sprayed wildly out the doors of speeding automobiles. Their kind was almost enough to break the resolution of the servicemen standing watch against the barbarians.
There's movement.
Tara Garin was up from the stairwell, and she had two duffel bags, her hands and exposed forearms corded with the strain of holding their weight. The young American ran to her side, trying to take one of the bags, talking softly with her. Through his scope, Steiner watched her silent lips move harshly, nodding toward the young man's slung rifle. The man paused, then stepped away from the burdened Tara Garin, both hands on his rifle, eyes sweeping around. A small, can-like object sailed out of the stairwell, trailing a tail of smoke like a spool of gray cotton. As if on cue, as the smoke grenade bounced, the three people suddenly dropped to the ground. That's when the tall stranger emerged from the basement, a weapon in each fist. Mac Bolan was walking out of the cache, weighed down with three war bags, his muscles coiled like steel serpents around his arms against the weight of his gear. Bolan stopped halfway up the steps. Garin and Wesley were already outside the building. He was their guard, and he had to keep his eyes sharp and weapons tight in hand, ready for pitched battle. The executioner's spine tingled.
Come on, guys. I'm dying for a smoke here.
The young Afghan was trying to say something, but not be blatantly obvious so that anyone watching within ambush range could hear them. Bolan set his bags down and reached for a canister grenade.
What brand you smoke? Camels?
Not funny. In fact, I'm deadly serious.
There was no mistaking it now. Laith was asking Garen and Wesley to get moving, asking for smoke cover, and saying the situation was deadly serious, but not asking what was keeping Bolin so long. The executioner sent the smoker sailing over his allies, and their bodies struck the ground. Bolin plunged his hands into one war bag, pulling out an M4 that he slung over his neck on its nylon strap. The executioner had sprung the trap early. He filled his fists with the Desert Eagle and the Uzi and stormed up the steps. He spotted a couple of Taliban militiamen fanning the smoke with rifle fire from the cover of a shattered storefront and swung both guns toward them. Blood poured from crater-sized impact wounds in one of the gunmen, while another, who had taken a burst of fire from the Uzi, lay on the ground, twitching as he reached for his fallen weapon.
Laith! Wesley! Get the gear! Terra, make for the rover!
He was seeking fresh targets. Wesley and Laith retreated, their rifles aiming at a Toyota pickup that served as cover for a fire team. Their movement and fire had drawn enemy reaction. The executioner swung the weapons against his foes. There was a pause, as even through the smoke, Bolin saw the many surprised faces behind the car and walls registering the sudden silence coming from the tall wraith in combat black. Bolin's ice-cold eyes glared back at them, keeping them enthralled at the suddenly disarmed Angel of Death dropping his tools. That's when one noticed the M4 slung around his neck, spare magazines clipped to the central magazine, tripling the firepower of the rifle. The executioner's hand was on the pistol grip. Four close-packed Taliban militiamen had been torn open at the ribcage. The terrorists now ignored Laith and Wesley as they hastily scrambled to drag the supplies to the Land Rover. The Taliban veterans were showing their true colors. They emptied their rifles without any effort to control the violent bucking recoil of their weapons. All they achieved was to pepper empty air and loose chunks of broken wall that Bolin weaved around. Bolin, on the other hand, took the time to make dead certain that there was a body behind the front sight post of the M4. A lucky shot had deflected off a hunk of stone, striking Bolin. His mind instantly registered that it had struck where the armored, load-bearing vest covered his torso. The shoulder strap kept the bullet from penetrating, but it hurt like hell. The executioner took that as a hint to duck behind a foot-thick slab of wall. Once reloaded, Bolin swung around the side, spotting the Land Rover on the roll. He plucked another smoke grenade from his pocket, spotting a group of riflemen racing around the column of choking smoke. They probably sought to come up on the vehicle's blind side, but popping the pin, Bolin whipped the grenade, hardball style, at the group. It was only in the next heartbeat that the militiaman realized what had struck him, and he tried backing away from it. It was too late. His comrades slammed into him from behind, trying to continue their rush toward their enemy's vehicle. Bolin sought more targets as the grenade's fuse burned. The enemies were trying to pin in the Land Rover. However, they were wedged in too tight behind hard cover. They had opened fire on Bolin. They kept themselves low and out of the way. Hailstorms of comblock lead chopped away the stones that he was using for protection. With the bad guys suddenly developing a clue, it was time to bug out, but Bolin was too pinned down, and he'd used his last grenade already. Wesley and Laith suddenly poked out the window of the Land Rover, swinging their rifles at the two men firing on Bolin.
Get in, Colonel! We're stepping out!
Bolin threw his rifle to Garen and ran low, scooping up the Uzi and the Desert Eagle on the run. He was in the back seat, next to Laith. They were charging away from the battle scene, but Bolin knew the worrisome truth. The enemy knew that they were on the case and had set up an ambush. It had taken alertness, luck, shooting skill, and bald audacity to break the back of the ambush. And once more, Bolin had proved his willingness to take a bullet for an ally, but not before putting a few dozen into his enemies first. The knock at Michaela Bronson's door had made her heart leap. Her hand slid into the desk drawer for the little pistol she kept there. It wasn't much, but at least she wouldn't go down without a fight, unlike Sophia. Michaela stepped from behind her desk.
Come in.
Her office was small, but she had a filing cabinet that she could use for cover if the newcomers were hostile. She didn't know what to think, especially with someone coming to visit her at midnight while she was on duty. She didn't think that the terrorists would be polite enough to knock before entering the office of someone they were coming to kill, but maybe they were making sure someone was there to shoot in the first place. She tensed.
Don't be alarmed, Dr. Bronson.
The voice reminded her of her favorite instructor back at Johns Hopkins, the voice of a man who could break bad news to you and yet comfort you in the same sentence. What stepped in, however, was no kindly man in a white lab coat. He was a tall, black-clad commando, face smeared with grime, bedecked in what looked like the latest U.S. Cavalry catalog gear. She was taken aback by his appearance, but he smiled at her.
Forgive my appearance, Doctor. My name is Colonel Brandon Stone, and I'm here to ask if you'd please accompany me into protective custody for a few days.
Michaela was speechless. She looked down at the pop gun in her hand.
I can fend for myself.
Not with that.
I'm a pretty good shot.
Michaela noticed there were others out in the hall. All of them were dressed for a fight.
You don't look like you're going to stay away from any danger.
We're not. But we're going to keep you out of the sights of the bad guys.
Garen stepped forward. Michaela was surprised that such a small-statured woman could carry the full pockets on her vest and the huge rifle in her delicate little hands.
Dr. Bronson, Michaela, there are some very dangerous men after you. They're not merely ex-Taliban militiamen. There are 6 former members of a covert Israeli black ops unit who have stepped over the line. The Mossad and the U.S. Justice Department are working together to bring them to justice, but we have to make sure you're in safe hands first.
He held up a vest.
This is ballistic nylon with trauma plates. It weighs a ton, and I don't promise it will become comfortable anytime soon, but it's better than a sucking chest wound.
Michaela reached out and took the vest, almost dropping it. The weight of the Kevlar pulled her arm down, and she stumbled forward. A hand flashed from outside the room and grabbed her upper arm, yanking her toward the door while a massive shape lunged past her. Another pair of hands grabbed her and pulled her through the doorway, carrying her like a rag doll.
Goro! Go!
Fear cut like a knife through the doctor's stomach, but she remembered what Colonel Stone had said and squirmed into the battle vest. It was tight and weighed heavily on her shoulders. But it was more comfortable than a sucking chest wound. Luck had been on the executioner's side. Had Dr. Michaela Bronson not been thrown off balance by the weight of the protective body armor he'd handed her, she'd have ended up dead, a bullet caving in her ribcage. As it was, they weren't out of danger simply because Wesley was taking her away from the sniper's arc of fire. Instead, Boland shouldered his M4. The scope atop his rifle brought the far side of the street and its rooftops into sharp relief despite the starlit night. It had only taken a moment for Boland to line up the point of impact and the former hole in the window to give him a bearing on where the shooter was. He had peppered a window on the top floor of the building across the road. There was no glass to shatter, and the 5.56mm rounds had kicked out clouds of concrete dust and stone chips in a savage display of his rifle's power. It wasn't the most outstanding display of ammunition conservation, but it had been suppressive fire, and it was only half of one magazine. Boland held his fire and took cover, waving down Garen. The Israeli ducked behind the desk. With the cessation of hostilities from the executioner, there was movement. Boland made a decision to test his opponent. He presented only the barest fraction of himself. The rifle he carried protected what bit of his face poked around the window frame to look across the street. He kept his arm low, the wall and the weapon likewise protecting his hand and forearm. It felt like a freight train had smashed into his chest. No sparks of agony flared to inform him of a fresh new batch of broken ribs from this close call with death. He felt where the bullet struck and saw a crushed magazine in his pocket. The aluminum caved in as if it were a soda pop can. He pulled the magazine from its place. The damaged shells had spilled gunpowder. Boland swept them toward the wall in case he had to run. He looked at the slug embedded in the magazine's wall.
What the hell? Are you okay?
I'll live. Keep your head down, though.
He touched his throat mic.
Wesley, you have the doctor?
Yeah.
She in her armor yet?
She's dressed not to be killed.
That vest won't stop a headshot, and it might not even stop whatever the sniper's using. He's got an 8mm Mauser.
Is that bad, teacher?
It's more powerful than most of the rounds these vests are designed to protect against. Not by much, but it is pretty powerful. Lathe, any movement outside?
I've got a couple of bad guys heading for the front door. Want me to
no.
get them?
I don't want to tip our presence just yet. Hang tight until the bad guys throw more reinforcements at us, or we come to pick you up.
Ace in the sleeve. Over and out.
Bullen was relieved that Lathe wasn't disappointed. However, he wasn't thrilled to hear about the pair of shooters who were coming through the front of the hospital. At this time of night, most of the patients were in their rooms, but there was still staff about. The last time Abraham's Dagger had sent a Taliban squad into a hospital, it was a scorched-earth policy, and he wasn't sure that policy would change if there was a sniper at work.
Wesley, you heard that?
Did indeed, Colonel. What should we do?
Take Dr. Bronson and slip out the back. Don't attract any attention from the bad guys. And tell any on-call staff to get undercover.
And you too?
Bolin remembered a term his able team friend Herman Schwartz used a lot.
We gotta take care of a pest problem.
Tara Garen slipped out of the office with Bolin behind her. She slung her rifle, realizing that its length would only snag and trip her up in the halls and doorways of the hospital. Instead, she pulled her micro-Uzi machine pistol from its harness and gave Bolin a nod. A 33-round magazine was in place, and she was confident in her ability to cut through any opposition with the 9mm chatterbox.
Laith, any more coming in?
Just the two I saw coming in the front. I can't vouch for any other entrances, though, so be careful.
Careful is my middle name.
Really? Mine's Cornelius. But if you tell anyone, I'll have to kill you.
Cut the chatter. Find some other way to cool your nerves.
Garen nodded, looking back, expecting to see the big soldier, but he had disappeared. She walked swiftly, keeping herself tight to one wall or the other, always sweeping her eyes in an arc, looking for trouble. Her ears strained for any stray sounds betraying the approach of an enemy. A nurse stepped out of a room and saw the Israeli terrorist hunter. The nurse seemed almost comedic, dark-faced over a white old-fashioned outfit like something out of a cartoon. She paused, her round face wide with surprise. Garen raised her finger to her lips and shook her head.
Get into the patient's room and stay there.
The nurse nodded and disappeared into a room. Garen took three long strides and reached an intersection. An elevator was coming up, its indicator showing the car's progress. The red-headed fireball pressed herself against the desk, crouching low, thankful she was short and already a small target. A single man stepped out of the elevator. She tensed but kept her finger off the trigger. The man was a clean-shaved Arab, but he didn't look like a local. His dress was too Western, and he looked, for all the world, Palestinian. He could have been a member of Abraham's Dagger. The Dagger was made up of agents chosen specifically for their ability to blend in with Palestinians and Israeli-born Arabs in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and other similar territories. But something seemed wrong. He had a weapon, its ugly shape creating an equally ugly bulge under his jacket, but he became more worried as he looked around. He took a sudden sidestep toward her, and she sprung to her feet.
Keep your hands where I can see them!
The man froze, and she got a good look at his face. It was Marid Haytham, and he looked like a deer caught in the headlights. He put his hands out.
There's 8 members of Abraham's Dagger's goon squad right on my heels, Garen.
You know me?
It pays to know my enemies and the enemies of my enemy. I've been watching you for days.
The woman pondered Marid Haytham's reputation. He was known as a straight shooter and someone who fought only those who could fight back. In a war where his brethren struck at the unarmed and the helpless as a means of showing the Israeli government their willingness to fight, Haytham limited himself to those whose job it was to get in harm's way. It didn't make him a saint by any stretch, if by some chance she should actually start acknowledging saints, but it did give her pause.
Get undercover, Haytham. And the first time you turn that gun on me...
I know.
He was too smart to get any closer to her. The Palestinian turned and went down the hall, taking cover in an alcove.
Tara, who are you talking to?
An old friend. He says we've got 8.
That much I figured. I've got 2 in my sights now.
And I have a couple of my own.
She crossed from the desk to the corner of the intersection, watching the 2 men, weapons held low, enter the hall. They looked both ways, but were scanning at chest height, which meant that Garen was below their line of sight. She lined up a laser on one of the gunmen. The other dagger quickly rounded the corner, rifle drawn. The man had been ripped apart by 2 salvos of lead. He never stood a chance. Garen glanced back at Haytham, who kept his weapon trained on the dying gunman, pointed away from her. She didn't love the situation she was in, but she could live with it. Bolin didn't like the sudden cryptic attitude Tara Garen had developed after her hasty conversation with the newcomer, but that wasn't his immediate worry as the 2 gunmen he saw were joined by another pair of locals. 3 of them looked like Taliban, but 1 didn't. To a less familiar eye, he would have passed for Palestinian on a good night, but the executioner had faced far too many enemies over the years. One of the things that kept him alive was his sharp senses and his ability to identify people almost instantly. The 4th man was a member of Abraham's Dagger, and he was in charge of the operation. Bolin took a sidestep, bringing up his Uzi pistol to deal with the team leader. The sudden flash of movement, however, had to have been enough to activate the paranoia-wired reflexes of the Dagger hitman. He lurched suddenly, stepping so that a Taliban gunman was between him and Bolin's line of fire. Since it wasn't an innocent hostage, Bolin didn't hesitate. After the thug had been peppered by Bolin's pistol, he then steadied himself, swinging up his rifle. The executioner didn't waste time concerning himself as to why four parabellum bullets weren't enough to knock the terrorist off his feet. He simply took a long sidestep, hit a crouch, and aimed for the man's face. Even as the man died, the bulletproof killer had triggered his AK. However, after Bolin had witnessed him strike the ground, he saw the telltale blue nylon shell of the body armor poking out from under his robe rags. That mystery was solved, but the soldier had other things on his mind as he scrambled for the protection of a heavy fiberglass waste disposal cart. Bolin's mind spread out as his body compressed behind the cart. There weren't many options for him in terms of cover unless he wanted to race across 10 feet of hall and receive a torso full of enemy autofire. Even with his own body armor, the combined fire of three rifles would probably cut through his protection, and a stray shot could always strike him in the head. The cover he was seeking was away from the three remaining gunmen, and Bolin wanted to get closer to the killers. He glanced at the wheels of the cart, then hurled his shoulder against the contraption. Suddenly, he had a tank to hide behind. It was only made of fiberglass and filled with garbage and medical waste, but it had stopped most of the bullets aimed his way. Guiding the cart with one hand, he swept up the Uzi, spotting one gunner angling around the side of the hurtling garbage container. Bolin aimed low. The terrorist had folded over as if he was stabbed in the groin with a hot poker. From the ground, he held his rifle toward the executioner again. With a second burst, Bolin had ended his suffering with a blast of slugs. The rolling fiberglass container surged against him now, trying to grind him under. Someone was pushing on the other end, putting a stop to Bolin's improvised tank. The executioner pushed himself out of the way of his former mobile barrier, pulling his Desert Eagle in one fluid fast draw. The thug shoving the garbage cart was off balance, with nothing stopping him from tumbling forward. Bolin had helped him with a 44 Magnum coffin nail through his throat. That left the Abraham's Dagger gunman. However, he was nowhere to be seen. The executioner braced himself for an even tougher fight. Crane Soze had ducked into a room while the inverted tug-of-war with the garbage cart was going on. He was impressed with how fast the mystery man had taken down the three hired hands. Passing a sleeping patient, Soze threw open the window. He'd need to get behind the big soldier, and that meant taking a wall crawler express. As he scaled the cement ledge, he noted that this wasn't the safest or sanest way to travel. However, Crane Soze was an expert at trailing suspects from rooftops in dense, packed third world cities, where ledges were wide and ornate and buildings scrunched tightly together. He scurried along the ledge three rooms down. After he had snaked through the window, he drew his handgun.
Soze, get out of there. We're not going to lose any more people against Garen and her team.
Soze remained quiet, pressing his cheek to the door. He hooked his finger into the wire of the earpiece and popped it free so he could devote his full attention to what was going on in the hallway beyond. Fingers squeezed tightly around the grip frame of the Heckler & Koch USP in his fist. Soze was glad the sad-eyed assassin wasn't a whiner over the radio. He had an opportunity to take out Garen and her allies, and he was going to take it. The Abraham's Dagger fighter stuffed the handgun back into its holster and gripped his AKM assault rifle, keeping the muzzle pointed at the floor. He watched the big, dark shape of the soldier pass around a corner. Soze slipped into the hall. He slowly crossed half the distance to where he was sure the mysterious American had disappeared.
Stone. Stone, you there?
Soze whirled and dropped into a crouch, taking cover behind a medication cart, taking quick mental inventory of his surroundings. It had been a woman's whisper. Tara Garen was behind him, and on the other side was the man in black. Not a good place to be, he realized, but at least he knew where one enemy was, which was more than what they knew. There was no whispered answer, but Soze wasn't expecting the other to give away his position. He gripped the AKM tighter, scanning over his shoulder. His tendons were taut like mousetrap triggers, muscles ready to snap at the first sight of prey. He clenched his eyes shut for a moment, hoping no one heard the sound of his joints snapping and loosening up. Death was close, and it was going to explode on this hospital floor.